To some, it might seem that there could hardly be a less likely starting point for two leading proponents of free market economics than the working class neighborhoods of Putnam and the East End of London. Yet it was here that two youths of the 1920s and early 30s were learning firsthand many of the lessons that would later inspire their lives' work. Work that would ultimately serve as an influence on political and social events in Great Britain and around the world. Ralph Harris and Arthur Seldon. Both grew up in working-class London neighborhoods and developed a profound interest in the fundamental ideas and institutions of a free society, with particular regard to the role of markets in solving both economic and social problems. They pursued this interest through the study of economics, and both were influenced early on by the work of Austrian economist and Nobel laureate Friedrich von Hayek. Ralph Harris was a political conservative in his early years and twice stood as a parliamentary candidate for the Conservative Party. Arthur Seldon, like many others who'd grown up in London's East End during the Depression, was a socialist in his early days. But he came to embrace classical liberal ideas while studying at the London School of Economics, where his instructors included Hayek. Both Harris and Seldon entered the world of academics. Harris as a lecturer in economics at St. Andrews University, and Seldon as a research assistant at the London School of Economics. But their interests were later drawn in another direction. In the mid-1950s, Harris departed his post in the academic world, and Seldon left his position as an economic advisor in the brewing industry to begin work with Antony Fisher. Fisher was a man with a vision of creating an organization dedicated to conducting research into the role of free markets and individual liberty in solving social problems. Fisher's vision of a free market think tank was in part influenced by his contact with Hayek. In 1956, Fisher recruited Ralph Harris to become the director of a fledgling organization, the Institute of Economic Affairs, the IEA. And in 1957, Arthur Seldon joined Harris and became the IEA's editorial director. Together, Harris and Seldon ran the IEA well into the 1980s. They soon began co-writing a number of publications that gave voice to what were, at the time, rarely heard views of economic reform based on free market principles. Over the next 40 years, their work, as well as the ever-expanding work of the Institute of Economic Affairs, had an enormous influence on governments, public policy, and economic thought, including a profound impact on one Margaret Thatcher, who'd been paying special attention to the insights of the IEA since she first met Harris and Seldon in the 1960s. Indeed, many of the policies enacted by Thatcher during her tenure as Prime Minister were the direct result of work being done at the IEA. As the IEA became the model for dozens of organizations like it around the world, the contributions to classical liberalism made by Harris and Seldon began to be fully recognized. Ralph Harris was appointed a life peer in the House of Lords, where he now sits as Lord Harris of Highcross. And Arthur Seldon was given the honorary title of Commander of the British Empire, one of the highest honors awarded to a citizen of the United Kingdom. Both Harris and Seldon continued to serve as directors emeritus of the still vital Institute for Economic Affairs, and both continued to work through their speaking and writing toward a freer society.
I was reading recently that Antony Fisher, who founded the IEA, was once told that he'd hired the last and only two free market economists in all of England. Is that the way it seemed to you?
Yes.
Economists are thought of as being left-wing, trendy, because the whole of the climate of opinion in those days was statist. It was post-war when the IEA started in 1957. And there was a socialist government after the war, then there was a Tory government with a large chunk of socialism built in, the consensus. And so economists didn't typically challenge that. They assumed that was the way that things were and that you had to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, in a sense. You had to, you know, had to sort of just offer little bits of advice, but nothing very radical. So that here were a couple of reckless, irresponsible market, full frontal market economists.
At the time, did you find it difficult to find an audience?
No. Yes. The young were naturally left-wing, I think. They seemed to have more compassion about the people whose incomes were low, and so on. And they tended, I found in my days, that I was thought to be rather exceptionally hard-hearted.
Yeah.
I wasn't conscious of the suffering of the, you know, of those who were poor and so on. It took some time before one had to say things or use arguments which were, won the confidence of the students. Nine-tenths of whom, Rafe, I think one can say, were left-wing in my days. In the 50s, I go back earlier than that. Even in the 1930s, it was even worse then, I think. It was even worse. But by the 50s, the a kind of thinking that Rafe and I were beginning to use and spread was beginning to be heard. Its impact was rather slow, very slow. It took us 10 or 15 years for the Institute to make a mark. Because we started off by appearing to be insensitive about the lowly.
Well, let's dwell on that, Arthur, because, I mean, this is a real part of the battle. It's a battle of intentions. It's like the goodies and the baddies. And the display of compassion and concern and all that is stock in trade of all politicians, particularly on the left, of course. And I think Arthur and I, my belief is that we were armed against undue sentimentality of that kind because we sprang from working class families. There's no kidding about that. But the idea that the whole of the working class population were incapable of running their own affairs, of making their own decisions, of learning to do better, was offensive to us. I mean, it was a kind of affront to have these paternalistic Tories or socialists saying that we know best and we can guide the workers or the labouring classes or whatever they like to call us. So that we were rather sharp about that and paraded our working class confidence, if you like to say.
I was appalled by the insensitivity of governments to the efforts of the working classes to help themselves, yeah, by doing all the things that we thought, you know, that they thought they ought to do. They were most anxious to ensure they use all the opportunities of insurance to safeguard their families in times of sickness and loss of income and so on. And I began to sense a sort of anti-working class sentiment in all political parties. They wanted the state to do these things, and yeah, they didn't like people to do things for themselves. They taught that ordinary people weren't capable.
That's
they
right.
Forgot all the history of the working classes. The records are that the working classes were sending their children to school by the 1860s. They were insured for health cover and so on by 1910, 11, when all parties in England, the main ones, Tory and Liberal, so-called, with people like Lloyd George and Churchill and Beveridge at the centre, passed the famous or infamous Act of 1911, which forced the working classes to insure with the state, in spite of the fact that nine-tenths of them were already covered by private systems. And from then, my bitterness against all politics, which seemed to me to be saying you are not competent. You are, you need us to ensure that, you take care of your families, yeah. Which was nonsense. The working classes were taking care of themselves.
You had a similar experience, Ralph?
No, absolutely. But Arthur said that they ignored history. The paradox is that the trade unions had been a major instrument of mutual aid. The trade unions coming through after the 1850s, 1860s, developed philanthropic things. They developed labor exchanges, actual ways of getting unemployed chaps in their trade into job. They developed old age benefits. They actually developed insurance schemes. And when the government in 1911, as Arthur said, produced these state schemes of insurance, they used the actuarial calculations of some of the better trade unions to base their contributions and benefit systems on. So that it was all a matter of impatience, that you couldn't wait for this to develop in a voluntary way and a spontaneous, natural way, as Hayek would say. You had to enforce a common standard system on everybody and compel contributions and let the politicians, for electoral purposes, determine the benefits.
Arthur, were there events in your personal life that drew you to your thinking?
Yes, there was one early on. At my age of 9 or 10, my foster father died, and I learned from that event that he had covered his wife and me and others for the insurance sum, and within 2 days the secretary of the Friendly Society, which had covered us by insurance, arrived with the huge check of £100. Which looked after us for two or three years. Yeah. And that taught me that, hey, if he's doing it, others are doing it too. And from that I learned that far from a government having to do things, the ordinary people were learning because of their consciousness of their own selves, their wives, their families and so on. And from that I think I must have learned. That was the early beginning of my suspicion that government was doing far too much, and that it should lead people, even those whose incomes were low, to do things for themselves.
Do you have a similar sort of experience, Ralph?
My dramatic memory was when my mother died, the other end of my life from Arthur's youth. And I found in a shoebox four policies. She had four children, my mother. And I found four policies taken out on our birth when we were born, for funeral benefit. This fear the working class had that they wouldn't have the money to bury their dead. And so you could take out a penny halfpenny a week, not a cent even. An insurance policy to pay £5 on the death of any of these children. So four children, four policies, sixpence a week altogether, and £5 on it. Now, that was precaution, prudence, and the best kind of working class thrift, if you like. Secondly, when my mother died, the £5 wasn't worth a bean because of inflation. Inflation was a great enemy of self-provision. That you insured, you had the hope of money, you put money on the shelf for a rainy day, and then inflation would render it useless, and their government would have to come in. So that was one of the reasons that moves things more and more into the public sector.
If I remember, in 1949, Anthony Fisher heard you give a talk in Suffolk. Uh-huh. And 7 years passed, but in 1949, he told you that he was going to put the money together and start an institute. But it was 7 years before that happened.
Yes, I had kept a bit in touch with Anthony. I was then working in a university in St. Andrews in Scotland. I came down at holiday times and I met Anthony occasionally. The great thing about Anthony Fisher is that he was a nonconformist. Though he had been an Etonian, he was a country gentleman, he had an extensive farm and all of that, but he had this bee in his bonnet that the war had been fought, and he had been in the Air Force in the war, over freedom and individual self-expression and so forth. And increasingly, the state seemed to be closing in on people, all parties. And so that to meet Anthony was a breath of fresh air. And when he got a bit of cash and said, look, we're ready to go and start up this institute we've talked about, I mean, almost recklessly, we threw ourselves into this. First me, then Arthur, soon after.
Well, Rafe, there had never been anything like this before. The academics, mostly on the left, the mild left, who thought the government ought to expand itself and so on, were mostly sympathizers of left-wing thought. We were the only people, it seemed to me at the time, to think of establishing something that was revolutionary. We had the nerve to say that all the thinking that was being done by these hard-working, well-meaning young men was wrong, that they were working on fallacies, and that we would challenge them. And somehow that was a revolutionary thing to have said, even before we had published our first works.
Now, you quickly developed a publishing arm, and very quickly, I think, sought out people who would write for you. Is that right?
Well, that took time. Even our difficulty in finding people of adequate quality to write the kind of works that we had in mind were so scarce that Rafe and I had to join together and write three of the main works ourselves in 1958, 59, and 60. Those were the ones that, which I think, you know, we wrote on hard purchase credit. As you call it in America, we wrote books which made their mark on advertising, which was universally scorned. Wasteful, taught the wrong values and so on. And our third effort in those early years, what's the last one?
You did pensions.
I did pension, yes, myself. We started a series of surveys from 1960 into the supposed view that all the people were happy to pay higher taxes in order that government could spend more on schools, health services, and so on. From our learning of economic thought, we had a doubt about all that, and the reason was that all the surveys then being done simply asked, would you pay more tax if the government spent more on schooling and health services, our pensions, and other things? And we found that if we introduced the notion that that there was another way of financing the welfare services, and that was by payment, by charges or fees and so on, that standards of quality would rise. And we did that work over something like 10 years or more. And that began the very evidence that we then found, that people said, in that case, I won't pay higher taxes, I'll pay by prices. And that helped us on our way to show that there were other ways of supplying welfare services.
Whom did you try to reach? That is, who was your target audience?
Well, I'll tell you. This is where the financing came in. We hadn't the money to set up a major publishing effort and produce books for every man and get them through the bookshops and build up a sales force and all the rest of it. We had to think, how do we, with a few thousand pounds a year, make any impression? And so our target was, if you like to say, frankly, was journalists, writers, on good papers, Financial Times, The Times, The Guardian, and so, because if they would review our books, they would multiply the effect. And the books were themselves devised. Arthur and I sat down and thought, as students, what kind of book is useful? About 10,000 words, Arthur decided, was a decent read. That's about 40 or 50 pages with prelims. The book would have to have a reading list for further reading for students. The book would have to have footnotes to encourage the student to pursue the matters discussed in more detail if they wished. And they had to be presented in a lively form, and they had to be well written, accessible to a good sixth former, highest grade in secondary school, or first year undergraduates.
How long was it before you were paid enough attention that you would be attacked in the press? Did that come?
I think not much notice of us was taken by government people in office, in power, until 1966, when a minister quoted a paper of ours that argued that the so-called national plan of the government then was going to lapse or fail. And that was the first paper. We then began to feel that if we managed to get our work known by people in office, they would take us more seriously than they seemed to be doing in the early years. And from about the mid-60s, I would say that we had a feeling that we were at last being heard. But that was a full 10 years after we started.
Well, Arthur, it's the national plan. National plan. IEA created in operation 1957. National plan, that was the Labour government that came into power in 1964. 65, it put out a circular, a questionnaire to all of industry and business and so forth, asking them how much timber they would need, how much labour they would need, how much exports they would need. It was totally preposterous. We published a paper by a lapsed socialist, John Brunner, called The National Plan, predicting, before it was published, that it would be a failure, because you couldn't operate these macro magnitudes. You had no leverage to influence building export ships. And that national plan collapsed in 9 months.
Now, as you can imagine, we do a little background study before we do these interviews, and we find out dark, strange things. In your case, Arthur, why, if I don't miss or have wrong information, once upon a time you were a socialist.
Oh, yes. Yes. And it was easy to be one. See, I lived where people whose incomes were low and whose living standards were low too. And it seemed to me, at the age of 16, perhaps a little bit more than that, and 17, that it was logical, as the socialists then said and taught, that government would have to do more, to give them money, to give them free services. The welfare state was in its infancy, in a sense, and it seemed to me, but my early mind, my young man, I uncritically accepted the dominant view that it was up to government, and especially a Labour government, because they seemed to be saying more about what the workers ought to be given, and so on. So it was natural for the big-hearted, generous-hearted young people to think that it was the Labour Party, which was known as the Socialist.
What made it hard for you to stay a Socialist? Was there one particular event that just was a watershed event for you, or was this a gradual process?
My illusions were dropped when I went to the LSE.
London School of Economics.
As a student, where all the teachers were of the Hayekian types. It was not actually, although Hayek lectured at me from 1934, from the age of 18, from then I abandoned all my illusions that only government could do all the things that the people needed, and I began to switch from the view that the state was essential to seeing that the state was not doing them in the way that best suited the diverse circumstances of the workers.
Was it Hayek's views that inspired the two of you most, Ralph?
Well, for me, it has been Hayek that I go back to again and again for real inspiration. At this point, you hand me, without the canvas nesting, you hand me the book, the big book, I think. So, this is something of a Bible for me. It's the Constitution of Liberty, published in 1960, just after the IA started, and it has a marvellous final chapter called Why I Am Not a Conservative. Though many people thought he was conservative, right, not a conservative, but a Whig, he calls it, a Whig or a liberal. And this is the passage that I like to repeat to students. The main merit of the individualism which Adam Smith and his contemporaries advocated is that it is a system under which bad men can do least harm. It is a social system which does not depend for its functioning on our finding good men for running it, or on all men becoming better than they now are, but which makes use of men in all their given variety and complexity, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes intelligent, more often stupid. That is his defense of the free society.
I'd like to talk a little about the way you and two, pardon me, the two of you relate now. Yours is a very long-term relationship, and I gather it must be one of the more interesting relationships of your lives.
Well, I spent most of my working life with this man for 35 years. And so on. We bounce off each other. He always made me think harder about some of the things I was teaching or thinking at the time, and I then had to justify it a little more further. I suppose unless there was a basic sympathy of outlook and hope, it would have been difficult for two men to have lived and worked together in sympathy, with the occasional difference of emphasis, not difference of thought, as it were, but difference of emphasis. He used to say, well, no, that's going too fast. And I used to say, well, that's going too slow. This thing is happening faster than you think.
We had adjoining rooms, and they had open doors that were mostly left open, so that we were calling through to one another. And I can't think of anyone of my wide acquaintances that I could have conceivably worked, not even for a year, let alone 35 years, in that close proximity, and have as few frictions as Arthur and I developed. It was partly, for me, this working class bond. I don't want to become a militant working class lad, but I admired Arthur from his background in the East End of London and as an adopted son. And to see the way that he made and the aspirations that he had for other working class people.
That's the point.
And I, no less, felt quite proud of my working class origins. I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. If I met public school boys, I would mock their fancy accents, la-di-da and all that stuff, because these were the people who would condescend to see help the workers along with little state handouts and subsidies and benefits.
I gather you divided up responsibilities. You were mostly involved in publishing?
After the early years. After the early years. When we had the early 5 years or so, during which it was difficult to get authors of the right caliber, so some things that we wrote jointly. After that, the great virtue and value of Rafe for my personal mission in life, which was to get the ideas over, was that he was a past master at selling, at persuading, at explaining, and so on, but audiences of students and others and businessmen, and of course he raised the money. He was the source of the money which paid for our costs from about the mid-60s onwards, I think. So I found my salesman, as it were. He may have found his backroom boy. There was a saying at the office here that I ran the engine room. You know, I did the work.
I kept the shop. No, but it was, I mean, how much is just pure chance and happy accident, but we had a complete division of labour. I would consult Arthur about financial matters and all of that, and he would always let me see manuscripts and even proofs and ask for advice and so on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he was publications. He said to me, look, Rafe, I'm better on a loose rein. And I learned not to try and breathe down his neck too fiercely. And on the other hand, he was happy to leave me to raise money. The only arguments we ever had is, why don't we spend more money on publicity? Why not more on marketing? And it was a good point. If we had had unlimited money, we could have saturated the market with some of our stuff much more quickly than we did.
I gather early on there was an important need to be provocative in what you wrote and said in order to gather some further attention.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Well,
was this a kind of
conscious
strategy?
Well, he was, among his virtues was that he could write well. The fact that he wrote leaders for the Glasgow Herald, which meant that he wrote well. Whatever he said, he wrote well, and so on. I managed to work up a sort of column as well in the Telegraph, which was the only paper, the national paper, that began to see what our aim was. So on. So both of us were able to popularize, write in simple language, simply English, for the arguments of our authors.
The division of labor was that, I mean, Arthur was an ace editor who always has written lucidly and clearly and in simple, direct, accessible English. No jargon and complexities to keep the unwashed at bay. Our authors relied upon Arthur's editing. Hayek said the best thing he ever published was by the IEA, which Arthur had just taken a manuscript and just done as he wished with that publication. Best thing I ever wrote, said Hayek. So Arthur was perfecting these things. I was the old journalist monkey, you know, thinking of slogans, phrases. So I thought up, as well as best I could, the titles. So we had these excitable titles like The Price of Blood, Anything But Action. Think of some other of my...
Down really with the Poor.
Were there any special early successes that you really relished that gave you a sense that, yes, it was beginning to work and work well, that you were progressing?
Dennis Leeds, who got his chair a number of years after he worked on for us, had written a short piece in The Times saying that the desirable range of health services would never be established unless out of taxes, and that before long, and this was The Times 1962, before long, the nation and all parties and all schools of thought would have to consider other sources of revenue. He did well out of that. Do you remember that?
Yes, there was a
Made him famous. It made him famous.
Exactly.
There were lots of comments on that. He's right, he's wrong, he's half right, he's half wrong. But we made news.
He did a Hobart paper called Health Through Choice, which presented the classic contrast between a developing, ingenious, innovative, private free-range scheme and this stark state monopoly that we still have. And he became a professor quite soon after that. By the way, we paid these authors peanuts. We hadn't much money anyway. And in the early stages, we chose younger economists and we paid them 100 guineas in those days. That was £105. And that was all, no expenses and trips or treats. And gradually, we had queues of people wanting to write Hobart papers, genuinely, because they saw it was a way of making progress in academia, of getting attention, and making the way.
We asked them to be daring. Now we asked them to be unconventional, unorthodox, and daring in the analysis of the subject on which they had worked. And we told them to persevere even if their conclusions were unwelcome, awkward or wouldn't suit the establishment. There's one man or two men who wrote the case for charging for blood. Hell broke loose. Wicked, unkind. But there was a man who nearly lost his life because there was a shortage of blood. And his blood of a rare group took some time to find, and he was saved. But this man asked the surgeon, "How is it you are short of blood?" And he said, "Oh, well, we don't want to charge something as important as blood, you know, but we think that people ought to give it." I said, "But are they giving it free?" He said, "No." I said, "Would you rather..." No, sorry. But the patient said, "Well, would you rather I had died rather than charge?" "Oh," he said, "that's a difficult question."
But what makes you sound so courageous, even daring, is that no one would have known at the time that this would succeed. You might, so to speak, have been out on the street without a job by 1960 because things didn't work out. You took a risk.
The answer?
Yes.
Faith that we were right. Faith that the thinking that was being understated, ignored, and so on, but by academia, would re-establish itself, and that we are in the, and that if we could risk some years of our lives and our wives, in a sense, that we would get there in the end. It was an act of faith.
I have a difference with Arthur.
Yes.
Arthur said we were born up by faith and so forth. I would just amend that a tiny bit, at least provisionally, tentatively. It was knowledge. It was not, once we had read, speak for myself, once I had read Hayek's writings, I saw that it was inconceivable that an efficient economy could ever be established based upon central direction, because in Hayek's more elaborate formulations, you could never collect enough knowledge at the center to reach out and indicate to all of the independent actors around the economy what they should do about investment, production, exporting, importing, and all of that. We know that the market economy is necessary to bring together the information. It's an information sharing system, is the market economy. So that, I mean, really, we did have this more than faith. I mean, we had this knowledge that the economics wouldn't work.
But the sequence was, we had faith that knowledge would work.
Well done. We had faith that knowledge would work.
One thing is clear, ideas have really mattered to you. Which were the ideas that drove you as you began your work together?
Ideas? Go on, Arthur.
Oh, with me, the idea was that only in open markets would people realize the maximum merits of their faculties. It's only in markets, in the long run, that people will do themselves good for themselves, that their families, or that their causes, the church, only by doing good to others. It's because others will gain from the activities that they offer, or services, or advice, whatever they offer. It's only if they benefit others that they will do good for themselves and their causes. That's the moral justification of markets.
At that time, at least, didn't many people think markets were flat out immoral?
Oh, they thought the markets were solely a device for maximizing your profits at the expense of customers. What the left taught. That's what the left in the markets. It was only government which would have the impetus to do good for you by taking your money and spending it. You would never know who the best sellers of services were until you had a choice between a number of them. The government gives you one choice. It tells you, give us your money and we will give you goods and services in which you have no choice and from which you can't escape. Immoral. The market says, give us your money or give it to us rather than to our rivals, and we will give you more than they will. That is moral.
Alas, you need government. But big government is subject to such flaws, incorrigible flaws. Big government is irresponsible government because they can't know all of the circumstances of the nation, of the society, of the families that they are administering. big government leads to all kinds of deals, behind the backstage deals about policies and that kind of thing. And all the time, they're governed, not by public interest, but by the self-interest of politicians to maintain their power. Now, you need politicians. But the more you can contain politicians into the essential tasks they have to do, the less you tempt them into this vote-grabbing and this corruption and deceit, which is inseparable from modern mass, undiscriminating democratic politics.
Government starts too soon. It doesn't wait to see if markets can supply something better or in other ways. It starts soon. Once it's in, it goes much too far. It does more things than it was authorized to do by the vote. And not least of all, once it's in, it stays too long.
It goes on and on.
The welfare state, it goes on and on, whatever the circumstances. It is impossible to make government accept the logic of their function, that at the most they have been called for a short time to do a little and to get the hell out of it. Out of it. And they don't. And this is the lesson. This is the lesson we have yet to learn.
You've written that cash gives choice and liberty, whereas welfare systems enslave. Could you say something more about that?
Yes. Our welfare state gives the poor, the sick, the halt, the lame, and the blind, it gives them goods, services, which means treating them like children who have no power to choose or to make or have a view. You treat them as though they were age 10 or 12. They have no choice. You give them a comfort, which may work for some time, but you deny them the power, the sense that people have the power to make a choice and to say, I'd like to try this first before I see which is as good, or worse, or better. A welfare state that was sensitive to the feelings of people who were being helped is to say, you can have either cash or kind. And you take the risk. We think that if you have cash, you will in time learn where to get the best schools, the doctors, homes, and so on and so on. But it is a symptom and a symptomatic weakness of all governments that we have lived under, that they do prefer but to give services, goods and services.
But that's the essence of the thing. That's the essence of the welfare state.
That's a risk we have to take.
That is paternalism. That is to say, you do treat people as children and you go on treating them as children. One of my favourite quotes is from Nassau Senior in the last century, who justifies state education as a preliminary process of spreading education among current young people, so that at some stage, he said, towards the last quarter of the 20th century, people would have learned the value of education and would wish to pay for it themselves. Now, we've had a century of compulsory, universal, state-provided education. We are constantly informed in the press by researchers that there's a 20% adult illiteracy rate, that half of the children are below the reading age the reading skill they should have reached at that age. State education is one of the most terribly flawed, failed industries, services in the whole of this nation. There's no way that a private educational company could have gone on for 100 years with a worsening output, with every sign of failure, and go on being funded and funded. Yet state education can do that.
As the 60s progressed, not the least of your efforts involved a growing relationship with Margaret Thatcher. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think Arthur was a bit more nervous about this than I was, and I suppose that she must have known, I had never discussed, that I had been a Tory candidate, Liberal Unionist candidate, back in Scotland in 1955. But we really had no intimate relations, no particular relationship with Thatcher. until the 1970s, and she didn't stand out as obviously a coming lass. And the idea of a lady anyway being a prime minister or very prominent in the Tory party would not have struck us as being very plausible. So that it was only in the medium 70s, through Keith Joseph as much as anything else, that we met Margaret Thatcher. And we had her with other MPs. We had Labour MPs and journalists and so forth. But I remember in this room here, on this carpet, introducing Margaret Thatcher to Hayek in the 80s, now when she was Prime Minister. And the unkind quip I always make is that she's known as being a rather overpowering lady, and she sat down like a meek schoolgirl and listened to Hayek. And there was a period of unaccustomed silence from Margaret Thatcher. She said nothing for about 10 minutes while he deployed his argument.
Well, I've heard this put two ways. One is that you were Thatcherites before her time, and the other is, well, there wouldn't have been Thatcherism without your ideas.
In a sense, in the sense that she copied some of the things that we had argued for years and years and years, to call it by her name, we may, it's arguable that we anticipated her, but that's not likely, because in her younger years, when they were in the 60s and the early 70s, there was little sign that she was going to act on our thinking. But certainly she is the head of a government that did more in her 10 years than any other since the war, including Churchill and Lloyd George and all the others.
And yet she did more for IEA ideas, practically speaking, than any other prime minister. Is this right?
Well, it was the great thing that had been a feature of our teaching. By the way, going back to the early days of the 1957-58 period, was the requirement to remove the legal privileges of trade unions. Trade unions in Britain had become, in the post-war years, completely in charge of whole industries, the steel industry, the coal industry, the car industry, the shipbuilding industry. And you had the constant strike threat being held over the heads of the employers. And you had the availability of subsidies from the government to prop up industries that had yielded to the strike threat and had been rendered uncompetitive. So you had the government bolstering the power of trade unions to extract unjustified wage increases. I mean, the thing, well, it was a kind of madness. You looked at it all and wondered how this could be sustained. And Thatcher took that one head on. And she, I mean, made war. There's no mistake about that. And to this day, even in places like the House of Lords, her name is execrated by the old trade union members of the Labour Party, because she defanged them, she took their power away. No strikes without a ballot. No strikes without a ballot. If you strike, you may be sued for damage you impose. If you strike, you can only pursue an industrial dispute in your business, not a political dispute to support another strike in the dockyards or somewhere else.
She did more to deprive a government of its powers. In her she did more than any other government. She did more than any other head of government to deprive it. It was her government, but you know, one that she inherited, to deprive it of the powers that they exercised in all the post-war years until her first year. She did more to de-socialise, to denationalise. Hers is the only government that did more than merely moderately alter the laws that govern unions' influence or powers.
When I had asked about the effects of Margaret Thatcher in terms of her putting into reality or putting into effect a number of your ideas, I sensed that you weren't quite as happy about the way that worked out as perhaps Ralph was. Did I misread you?
No, she did much more than any other head of government. But there were some things on which I had worked. Schools, for example, you know, these were my own special pet schemes. You know, there was a great child. Keith Joseph would have done school vouchers. To me, the welfare state is the worst bane on the backs of the workers. It's the thing that holds them back. You know, they're given things instead of having choice and so on. And King Joseph was interested and was going ahead quite well with the idea of giving the working classes money with which to pay for fees at private schools, which they hadn't had before. And he was doing quite well until the last month or two when it was being considered by the cabinet. I mustn't say this. What on earth am I doing? All go home.
You've written it in the Bowser Mystery or the Riddle of the
Bowser. Oh, okay. It's all there. Okay. So he had to confess and told the House of Commons on one day, February 1983, that although there was general commendation of the idea, which is a common conservative phrase for saying we love to do it, but it's too damn hard. It was thought that there was not going to be a harvest of votes, in the time that would make it politically profitable. So the whole idea was abandoned. But you know, I don't blame her for the things she didn't do. What I'm saying is that there was a lot that she did more than any other leader. But that there were some things that some of us had worked on for a long time, and which she said she was interested, and afterwards regretted that she had not done them.
Again, it's been a real privilege to spend this time with you, and I should probably just ask you one final time if there's any particular thing that you'd like to have linger with us.
I think if you feel you are right, you go on arguing until you are established as having told the truth. You can't live with the untruth if you feel you have found it.
So the truth really matters, popular or not.
Yeah, I don't think I would have enjoyed my life, apart from other aspects, if I felt that there was something I could have done, there were truths I felt I could have popularized and had an influence on the world, or our friends, our country. I think it would have spoiled the enjoyment I got out of the rest of my life. I mean, I could have turned aside from this place and earned much more, much at some stage, but much more. At the brewers, which would give me all the wine I wanted in the pier, and where salaries were very good. It wasn't my first choice, but I could have gone on there. Rafe, he speaks for himself, but Rafe would either have entered Parliament or have ended up as the editor of the Times.
My last word is this, honestly. The last phase of my life, not yet completed, is occasional attendance at the House of Lords. I meet some people of all parties who are very, very considerable figures, public figures, and so on. I discover that they will go into the lobby when voting time comes to support that for which they have no enthusiasm, to oppose that which they sometimes actually favour. And you see the extent to which important personages no longer feel themselves free to say exactly what they think. Now, it's less bad in the House of Lords, of course, than in the House of Commons, where they're slaves of the whips. But it does raise up, in my mind, this enormous gratitude to have had what Anthony Fisher called an independent station. He had a few phrases. Anthony Fisher was a Christian Scientist, and he was moved by a number of very simple adages, one of which he quoted from Archimedes. He said, "Give me a lever and I will move the world. Give me a lever and I will move the world." And he thought the IA was the lever and the fulcrum was market forces. He had another phrase, in bad times, things were difficult, and he would say, one of his sayings from his Christian Science, he said, "There is not enough darkness in the whole world to extinguish the light of a single candle." And you suddenly glowed, incandescent, you were a candle glowing in pitch black. I mean, Anthony was an enormous inspiration. But this was so true, and you knew exactly, transparently, exactly what this man believed. And I hope he felt the same of us.
Well, many of us believe that the IEA has been that candle. And how shall I put it? The two of you have been its flames. Thank you very much for our time together.
Thank you.
Thank you.